are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
After John described the millennial kingdom in Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6, he then described the last battle that will end the millennial kingdom. After the last battle, at the end of Revelation 20, he describes the great white throne judgment. At that judgment, all people, non-believers, will be judged and cast into the lake of fire. And then after that great white throne judgment, John described for us in the beginning of John 21 the creation of a new solar system and planet Earth. Now, he zooms in even more from the big picture view all the way down to a particular city on this new earth. And he's already mentioned this city in verse 2, the Lamb's Bride. Of course, she's called the Lamb's Wife here in this passage, but he is giving us a more detailed look at this city in the new earth. The first two verses of this section, this description, verses 9 and 10, show us that John received a special invitation to tour this city from an overlook. He got to take a very close look at it. This invitation came from one of the seven angels who had a previous job in this book, one of the seven angels who poured out the bowls of the wrath of God. Also gave this invitation. Of course, this angel had poured out God's wrath on the previous earth and the system of Babylon, that great city, that whore, Babylon, the prostitute. But now, this angel is showing John to look at a contrasting city, the New Jerusalem, the bride of Christ, in contrast to the prostitute of Babylon. The angel invites this up-close view from an overlook on a very big, high mountain somewhere in that area, and that it is called a wife and a bride indicates that the focus here is not just on the physical city, but on the people that are in it as well. Sometimes in Scripture, whether we're speaking about this city or the people in it is not entirely clear, but both are a part of this bride of Christ concept. Also, this is the city that in verse 2 we already knew, and now we see again, was not created in this new heaven and new earth. It actually descended, having previously existed from the heavenly realm, God's presence in heaven. John goes on to describe how this city shines brightly in verse 11. He describes this city as radiating with brilliant light. The light was so bright that John struggled to describe it well. And so to describe it, the best he could come up with was kind of a threefold description. This light was like a precious gemstone. And it also had colorful hues, brownish, reddish, bluish hues, like a jasper stone. At the same time, it was clear, like crystal. Now, I'm not an artist, and so to paint that or even to envision that in my mind is not entirely clear, but a very rich, clear, crisp, brilliant, bright light shine from this city. What's important here is that this light did not come from the lamps in houses of this city, but from God himself. If you're familiar with first century culture, when people traveled from one city to another, they were traveling from locations farther out. They would have to leave the walls of their town, village, or city and travel through wilderness, barren, open areas on foot or by donkey or camel or something like that. And when the night would fall, they would be at risk. It would get colder, it would get dark, the moon would come out, but thieves, robbers, wild beasts would sometimes be a threat to them. And so they also did not have GPS or compasses as we know them today, or cell phones that showed them what to do with Waze or Google Maps. And so what they would do is they would look ahead under the star-filled sky, which was dark, and they would look ahead and they would look for the lights of the city on a hill. It was not lights that they looked for as we think of today, the bright lights of a baseball stadium, something of that nature. But the more houses that were in that city, especially on the city walls, there would be an effect of light that would radiate from that city at a distance. And the closer you would get, the brighter it would become to you. And so as people would light their lampstands in their houses and set them at the window, all those lights combined would create a large lantern effect for travelers going to that city. That helps us understand what John is describing as a first century person. This city didn't have lamps and lanterns like cities did in those days, because God himself, the Father, and the Lamb, Jesus Christ, resided there, and they themselves emanated and produced enough light from themselves that there was no need for lanterns and things of this nature. God himself was the light of this city. John then gives significant attention to the impressive walls that surround this city, including the size of them, and therefore the size of the city itself. The wall surrounding the city was very large. It was great. It was very tall and high. Therefore, it was very imposing and impressive. Wow. The city walls were impressive. This wall around the city had 12 gates. Now, these gates were probably not clumped together closely, as you will see. Because of the size of this city, there would need to be multiple entry points in and exit points out. An angel was stationed at each gate. So at each gate, there was an angel. I don't know if they were standing or hovering, it doesn't say, but there is an angel at each gate, signifying safety, protection, guardianship. Each gate featured the name of one of the tribes of Israel. This means that as the people and the kings and the nations of the new earth come and go through this city, like people do on the Lincoln Tunnel and the George Washington and the Verrazano and the Mario Cuomo Bridge, all of these entry and exit points of New York City, people come and they go. And what do they do on the signs? They put names on them. As I mentioned, the Mario Cuomo Bridge, the Verrazano, the JFK, the Lincoln Tunnel. Why do they do this? Because people are forced to look at it, to talk about it, and to think about it. Where are you going in? I'm going in at the Issachar Gate. Where are you going? I'm going in at the Benjamin Gate. That's always my favorite way to get out of the city. That's the idea. So because these gates, each one of them features another name of a tribe of Israel, as we think of major exits and entrances to cities today and their road signs and names, this is going to be an everlasting, eternal reminder to all people of God's faithfulness to the 12 tribes of Israel. His promises to them, unconditional, are eternal, and also are a reminder that the city that they find so central to their lives forever, our lives, is a result of God's promise and faithfulness to the 12 undeserving tribes of Israel. It's a beautiful thing. There will be three gates to the north, 3 to the east, 3 to the south, 3 to the west. This city will, and its foundation, its walls, will rest upon 12 large foundation stones. And the way this is worded indicates probably 12 massive tectonic stones. Large pieces of stone as large as states in America. Massive hunks of stone. 12 of them. And each of these massive stones that uphold the walls of the city will have engraved on them for all to see the names of the 12 apostles through whom God founded the church, the foundation of the church. And these names will be featured prominently on the foundation stones of this city. This will be a perpetual reminder of God's blessing through the gospel to the nations through the apostles and the founding of the church, bringing together all nations and Israel into one forever people of God. The church and the nation of Israel, though distinct, will be forever linked by the construction and the design of the walls and the foundation of this city. The measurements of this city are incomparably, immeasurably impressive. The measurements are given in a three-dimensional way: length, width, and height. And so many of us often conceive in our minds of a big, large cube, like a sugar cube, only massively larger. However, the cubical dimensions don't have to. They can, but they don't require an actual cube, as in a large box of a building. It could, in fact, simply measure out a square plot of ground, a perimeter like a square, with a skyline whose highest point is as high as the width and the length of the perimeter. It could simply be saying the skyline is as high as the city is long at its highest point or points. That is also possible, and it helps us to think about an actual city as we would think of them today, and yet still follow what John is saying. Now, the size is incredible. About 1,400 to 1,500 miles long, the same distance the other direction, and imagine buildings terracing to that height. That is as large as approximately, give or take a couple hundred miles, it's approximately the size of the bottom to the top of the United States of America, the continental states, and halfway from one of the sides of the coast to the center. So about half the size of the United States of America. That's about the size of this city. A city of this scale is likely necessary to house the numbers of believers from the centuries of history in one place, should they all choose to gather for worship at once. It will be a very large space. And though the city may not necessarily be a cube, the way that John describes it in a three-dimensional way, which we've already discussed, reminds us of the holiest place in the temple, 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 8. The holiest place in the temple where God's concentrated presence was at for worship in the nation of Israel was measured 20 by 20 by 20 cubits. It was a cube-shaped room, 20 cubits to a side. Here's the neat thing. that this city itself serves as the seat of the concentrated presence of God for eternity. There is a sense in which the rest of the new earth and the solar system then is the rest of the temple. The building materials are also focused here by John. They represent extravagant and opulent beauty and wealth. The walls were constructed from colorful jasper stone. The buildings within the city were constructed from gold that was so pure it was translucent. The 12 foundation stones were not just stones with gemstones decoratively kind of cemented on them. The way the translation reads sometimes, we get the impression that there are these 12 large, massive slabs of stone under the city with the names of the apostles on them, and then a lot of little gemstones just kind of popped on, stuck on with glue or cement or something in kind of a mosaical form. It's very likely the way that this is worded by John that these massive slabs of stone are not just granite with fancy stones pushed on them, but are themselves composed of nothing but these stones, or are, in fact, large versions of each 12 of these stones. Can you see the opulence, the extravagance of this? The 12 gates were each carved from a single pearl. I think it's probably best to envision it as a large, massive gate, as you would envision a large, ancient gate on a city. Not a large pearl just kind of sitting there like a big ball. The way John describes this is that each of the gates were carved, engineered, and crafted from a single pearl at a time. That's the best he could describe this. One pearl per gate, each gate carved out of that one pearl in an intricate and impressive design. It's a lot to take in. John is amazed, as we also should be. And then he says the street, and this is where we get the idea that the streets are all paved with gold in heaven. Well, first of all, this isn't heaven. I don't want to disillusion you, but the Bible doesn't say that the streets of heaven are paved with gold. This is a description of the New Jerusalem city that will come down from heaven and rest on the earth. That's what we know. That's what the Bible says. In particular, this is speaking about either A, the main street of this city, the main thoroughfare of this city, or B, the central square, the downtown square of the city. That's what this word refers to. The main thoroughfare that goes through the city, or the center downtown square of the city, is just like the buildings of the city. Pure gold, translucent, clear as glass. Gold with no impurities. This is not necessarily a reference to every street. And so we're not actually able to say with confidence every street is paved with gold. It's possible, but it just doesn't say that. And so we see this city, then, in its size, splendor, expense, and opulence will have no equal or rival. Today, we always ask the question, what's the largest city in America? And it's always New York City, and LA is also big and covers more land than New York City, but we have more buildings and people, right? Chicago and Houston will debate for third and fourth. Then we remember that São Paulo is much larger than New York City, and that's just getting started. And that doesn't even begin to enter into the discussion the cities of India and China, where New York City looks like the Little Leagues. And if you want to talk about skyscrapers, where there is the Freedom Tower, But what about the Burj Khalifa and all the other massive skyscrapers larger than the Freedom Tower in between? And so we have ways of which city is the greatest, having these kind of debates and discussions. Here's the point, friends. This city, the New Jerusalem, is not a debate. There is no city today or then that will even come close to rivaling this massive and majestic city. But what is most impressive about this city is not its opulence and not its size, but that God the Father and the Lamb will be the prevailing influence there. John was kind of surprised. He's looking and he's describing, and as a good Jewish person looking at any version of the city of Jerusalem, the thing you really want to make sure is there is what? The temple. Where is the temple? In fact, in the Old Testament, they would build the temple before they built the walls. Well, John's so impressed by the walls, he then gets to the temple afterwards, and as he moves from the walls into the city center down the main thoroughfare of the city, he says, wait, there's no temple there. Not a problem, I get it, because God the Father and the Lamb are the temple. As I mentioned already, the fact that this is measured in a cubical way reminds us that this city, as massive as it is essentially the Holy of Holies for the entire universe, and the rest of the new universe is the rest of the temple of God. God the Father and God the Son will be the temple. There will be no need for a building. The city itself will house God himself. John also observed that this city did not need sunlight or moonlight, because the light that emanated from the glory of God provided all the light that is needed. Here again, sometimes I think we misunderstand and overextend what the Bible says about the New Jerusalem to heaven or the entire new creation. The point here is not that, A, there is no sun or moon in the eternal state. John says there will be no need for sunlight or moonlight. Where? In this city. In this city, in New Jerusalem, there will be enough light production that people in this city will not need the sun or the moon to shine on them. There are places in New York City where streetlights burn bright. There are other places where it's quite dark at night. In the New Jerusalem, there will be no dark alleys, not even at nighttime. There will be no nighttime, we will learn later, because there will be such light from God. This also does not mean that there will be no need for sunlight or moonlight in the rest of the new creation. In fact, we should probably assume that in other places on the new earth, and certainly in the solar system, there will be some need for sunlight and moonlight. These things will function as God created them to do in the beginning. That was a part of his original design, and that will probably not go away. The Bible doesn't actually say it will. But wherever we are at any time in the solar system and on this earth, when we decide as individuals and as nations and as people, I'm going to go to New Jerusalem for a while, it will not be hard to know where to go. You'll see the light shining, perhaps even around the curvature of the earth. Like, yeah, it's over there. It's over there. And the closer you get, the brighter the light shines until you get there, and you'll forget there's a sun and a moon the whole time that you stay. This city will be one that is not illuminated, as I mentioned before, by the lanterns of the people living or visiting there. It will be illuminated by God himself, and that will be its light source. And we will never fail to find it. Finally, in the last few verses, John points out that the city will be the global economic and political center. Throughout eternity, people who've been saved from all nations of the world today will exist in that world, and they will come and go from this city just as people come and go from Washington, D.C., or New York City, or places like this. We will come and go, not just to worship, though we will find that quite irresistible. It is the worship of God that will bring us frequently to this place. And when we go, we will not resist the urge to worship. This will also be the center of political, governmental, and economic, commercial activity. There will be rulers. There will be nations, there will be ethnicities in the new earth doing what nations do without sin. But it will be impossible to function as nations without regular and even high-level repeated visits to the New Jerusalem. It will have no competitor and no alternative. Finally, John points out what he has already pointed out of the eternal state, the universe and the world. He points out that there will be no evil influences or influencers, abominations, unclean, liars, deceivers, allowed to go into these gates, even if they could enter into the new earth, which they cannot, from the lake of fire. But he assures us. Why? Well, you tell me the name of a single city in the history of the world that hasn't had the problem of sin permeating its society. In fact, if you want sin, you go to the city. Now, certainly sin is everywhere. We know that. It's even lurking in the farthest corners of rural America. Wherever there is a farmer, there is sin. Wherever there is a person, there is sin. But there is certainly sin concentrated and lurking in the shadows of the cities of the world. But in this city, there will be no evil at all. It will be a crime-free, sin-free zone completely. So our key takeaway tonight is this, that the New Jerusalem inspires us to look for something far better than what we have today. As one man observes, that the mess we have grown accustomed to in the cities, in the world that we live in today, seems just fine. We cope, we deal with it, we survive. Until we catch sight of something far better. Even the United States of America is not that shining city on a hill we like to think it is, or will it ever become what we envision? There is only one such city, the New Jerusalem. You know, we like our house until we see a bigger one. We like our car until we see a faster one. We like our job until we see a more enjoyable one. And we like our city. We like our town until we see a cleaner one, a safer one. Though this experience often fuels a sinful, ungodly covetousness and dissatisfaction, discontent with what God has provided for us, this experience of wanting a better city, a better life, is actually wholesome and godly when the city that you are longing for is the city of God. It's okay to covet that city. It's that aspiration that motivated Abraham to leave his birthplace and city behind, Ur of the Chaldees, an opulent, godless, but very successful commercial, religious, political center. He left that into nothing. He didn't even know where he was going because he was looking for something better. By faith, Hebrews 11 says, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelled in the land of promise as in a foreign country, as we do today, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. It's the New Jerusalem, the one that would rest on the site that God promised, but would come from God as promised. And it's this same aspiration that should motivate us to live like pilgrims in the world today, as Abraham and not as permanent residents. Hebrews 13:14 says, "For here we have no continuing city. Why? But we seek the one that is to come." Oh, if you're from or live in for a while in New York City, you love the Big Apple. It's a badge of honor to say, "I am from New York City." If you're a police officer, you may not get paid as well in New York City as in other places. You may not get the respect as you might get in other places. But if you say, "I am an NYPD officer," it has an extra ring to it, doesn't it, of austerity. I'm an NYPD. We like our cities, don't we? If you grew up from rural America in a small town, you like to say, "Oh, I'm from such and such town." When I was a kid, I grew up in a town of 3,000 people, Spencer, Indiana. But if you ask people where they're from, "Oh, I'm from Sweet Owen County. Spencer is the county seat. The county seat of Owen County." But they would speak about that with a ring of honor. For us today, we find our pride in the city that is coming from God, the city that God built, this city. And we read the descriptions of it. No hometown, no city, and no exotic vacation destination that you're enthralled with compares to the city of God. If you are a first century Christian finding it hard to survive in a city of Rome, or you're being persecuted for your faith, or thrown into prison, or worse, you can look ahead knowing that you don't belong here anyway. You belong in that New Jerusalem, that city that is coming from God someday, and you have free access there, and you will not suffer there like you do here, because the source of your suffering will be removed from that place. And God himself will be with us. That's what's most impressive about this city. The New Jerusalem does more than nudge the present destinations of our world aside by an inch. It blows them away by miles, literally. But the most impressive statistic about this city is not its massive size or opulent appearance, but the fact that God the Father and Jesus the Son live there. When you go to New York City, people say, "Oh, I want to go in and I want to see the Freedom Tower and Ground Zero. I want to see the Statue of Liberty. I want to see Yankee Stadium. I want to see the Bronx. And I want to see the Central Park. And I want to see the Empire State and Rockefeller Center. And I want to go to Carnegie Hall and Broadway. I want to eat at Cat's Deli." And they have all these things lined up that they want to do when they come to New York City. And every city has its advertised special destinations and spots. What are you going to do when you go to New Jerusalem? I'll tell you what you can do. You can see God. There's no city in the world today, or even then, that will be able to rival that attraction. It will be the major destination because it has the greatest ever attraction, God Himself. And not just God the Father, but also God the Son, the Lamb who died for our sins. I can't wait to visit New Jerusalem because I can't wait to see God.